Grass up. Cliff looked down at the dog in the cage, silently assessing her as Buster continued.
This bitch ain't just a dog. She's money in the bank. She's a grub stake whenever you need it. She's like owning 5 falling horses.
A falling horse was a horse you taught to fall on the ground and not get hurt or not get scared. And in a Hollywood that made hundreds of Western movies and television shows, if you owned a horse that knew how to fall on the ground and then get back up again, you owned a little mini printing press of money. The only easier money was looking out and having a kid who became a successful child actor.
Remember Ned Glass? Buster reminded Cliff. Had that fallen horse, Bluebell?
Yeah, Cliff said.
Remember how much he made off that Jughead?
Yeah, Cliff remembered. He made a small fortune.
This bitch, pointing to the bitch in the cage, is like owning 4 Bluebells.
Okay, Buster, Cliff said. You got my attention. What's your proposal?
Look, I can't give you cash, Cooley honestly stated. At least not $3,000.
But what I can give you is half interest in the sunny fucking listing of dogs.
Cliff listened as Buster illustrated his plan.
I got $1,200. We put her in a dogfight they got running in Lomita. Bet the $1,200 on her and just sit back and watch her go to work.
Once you see her in action, you'll realize her potential. Then me and you take her on the dogfight circuit. Pool our winnings. By fight number 6, we could both have $15,000 each.
Cliff knew Cooley wasn't conning him. He believed everything he just said. But Cooley was selling this as a sure thing, and Cliff never believed in sure things. Plus, dogfighting was illegal, not to mention distasteful. And there was just too much that could go wrong.
Jesus, Buster, Cliff complained. I don't want to fight fucking dogs. I just want my money. If you got $1,200 to bet, why don't you just give me that? Cliff negotiated.
Buster answered honestly. Because you and I both know I give you $1,200. That's all you're ever going to get, Buster stressed.
I don't want to pay you back 35 cents on the dollar. You are straight up fucking cat when I needed help.
And I want you to make a profit.
Buster bargained. At least go with me to the first fight in Lomita. Just watch her fight.
Trust me, Cliff. It's one of those thrilling things you've ever experienced.
She wins. That's $2,400.
You don't want to continue? The $2,400 is yours.
Cliff took another swig from his can of beer as he looked at the little muscle man in the wire mesh cage.
Buster finished his spiel. Now you know me. So you know I'm not scamming you. If I say it, I believe it, so trust me.
At least this first fight, this bitch can win.
Cliff looked to the little bitch in the cage, then to the son of a bitch standing before him with a beer can in his hand. Then he lowered on his haunches and brought his face parallel with the dog on the other side of the wire mesh. Both Cliff and the dog got into a staring contest. When the little lady could no longer handle the man's forceful gaze, she growled and snapped at Cliff. The wire mesh stopped the canine's teeth from puncturing Cliff's handsome face. Cliff Booth turned and looked up at Buster Cooley.
What's her name?
Cliff, Buster, and Brandy went to the first fight in Lomita. And everything Buster said came true. Brandy was the real deal, and she killed that other dog in less than a minute. They won $2,400 that night.
Cliff couldn't believe how incredibly thrilling the experience was. Fuck the Kentucky Derby, he thought. This is the most exciting 45 seconds in sports.
Cliff was hooked. For the next 6 months, they went on the dogfight circuit all over Los Angeles County, Kern County, and the Inland Empire. They fought Brandy in fights in Compton, Alhambra, Taft, and Chino. And Brandy won them all, and won most of them easy. Only a few times did she get hurt. And even then, never too bad. and whenever she did get hurt, they took the time to let her recover. But after those first five fights, where Brandy seemed indestructible, the bets became bigger, and the competition more fierce.
Those fights took them to Montebello, Inglewood, Los Gatos, and Bellflower.
Brandy kept winning, but the fights became excruciatingly longer, far bloodier. She got far more hurt, and it took her far longer to recover. That was the downside. The upside was tougher dogs meant much more money when she won. After 9 fights, Cliff and Buster had made about $14,000 each. But Buster, knowing a good thing when he finally fell into it, had a number in mind. $20,000 each for him and Cliff. Then Brandy could retire. But it was during her 10th fight in San Diego, where the young lady fought a pit bull named Caesar, that she got hurt, and hurt bad. The fight was called off with no winner declared, and Cliff knew it was lucky for Brandy that it was called off, because if it had gone on 20 minutes more, Caesar would have killed her. In both wartime and peacetime, Cliff had seen loved ones cut asunder. But the agony he experienced watching Brandy taking the punishment she took from the vicious Caesar was more than he could bear. So he was shocked when Buster booked Brandy in another competition in Watts against a male monster named Augie Doggy before she had fully recovered from the last beating she took. But Buster was sure of himself. "Hey, man, I promised you $20,000, and I promised myself $20,000, and we're right there, man. This fight is the last fucking fight." "No shit, it's the last fucking fight," Cliff shouted. "There's no fucking way she can win against that beast Augie Doggy in her condition." "That's the beauty of it," Buster animatedly expressed. "She ain't gotta win. It's about her undefeated reputation. We enter her in the fight, and we bet on the other dog." That's when Cliff attacked Buster. They grappled in savage combat inside of Cliff's trailer for about 4 minutes, till Cliff broke Buster Cooley's neck, killing him. They fought around 5 in the afternoon. Cliff watched TV next to Buster's dead body till about 2 in the morning. Then, after the drive-in closed, Cliff crammed the dead body in the trunk of Cooley's car, a used white 1965 Impala sport coupe he'd bought with his Brandy winnings. With Brandy in the passenger seat, Cliff drove to Compton and abandoned the car there with the keys placed in the sun visor. He walked Brandy away from the car all night till daybreak. And when the sun came up, he and his dog hopped on a bus back home to Van Nuys. This wasn't the first time Cliff committed murder and got away with it. The first time was in Cleveland in the 50s. The second time was when Cliff killed his wife 2 years earlier. This was his third time, and Cliff got away with this one too. He never heard a word about what eventually happened to Buster Cooley or his car. In fact, nobody he knew ever brought Buster up again. That was last year. And since that time, Cliff's only fought Brandy twice, when he was really hard up for cash. But after the last time, Cliff promised Brandy, even though Brandy didn't understand, he'd never fight her again. And that was a promise Cliff intended to keep. In Cliff's trailer on Friday night, February 7th, 1969, he snaps his fingers and points at a chair. Next to Cliff's recliner sits a wooden chair with a little dog pillow on it. Brandy hops on top of it and takes her position on her hind legs, waiting for Cliff to prepare her dinner. Cliff takes his time preparing Brandy's dinner, even though he knows this is torture for the dog, but that's okay. Cliff knows better than most that torture can build character. Before he prepares her meal, he first opens his refrigerator and removes from a plastic six-pack ring a can of old Chattanooga beer. His small black-and-white rabbit-eared television is tuned to the local ABC affiliate, KABC, Channel 7. A commercial for Cliff's brand of cigarettes, Red Apple, plays on the little monochromatic screen. A 60s-era regular guy with brill-creamed hair in a black suit and tie stares into the camera in a head-and-shoulders frame. An off-screen announcer asks the guy, "Would you take a bite of a red apple?" The regular man answers enthusiastically, "You bet I would!" Then from below frame, he brings a big red apple up to his mouth and bites into it with a healthy crunch. Cliff takes a sip of his old Chattanooga and then lays the can on the kitchen counter. He opens his kitchen cabinet and removes two cans of Wolf's Tooth dog food. Good food for mean dogs. Cliff opens the can with a cheapy hand crank can opener, then dunks the muck, still in the shape of the can, into Brandy's dog dish. Knowing it's feeding time and watching the food slither out of the can and plop into her dish, it's killing Brandy to stay in her chair and not make a noise. But Cliff's trained her and trained her well. She might not know much, but she knows what's expected of her during feeding time. And she knows damn well that she must stay in that chair and sit without whining till her master gives her the signal that she can eat. On the black and white television screen, a 60s-era female Marlo Thomas type with a small bouffant hairdo stares into the camera in a head-and-shoulder shot as an off-screen announcer asks her, "Would you take a bite of a red apple?" She answers, "You bet I would." Then she brings a huge red apple up to her mouth and takes a big, crunchy bite. In her chair, Brandy wags her tail furiously from left to right while her muscled body vibrates with excitement, anticipation, and canine instinct. Now that Cliff is through plopping both cans of dog food into Brandy's dog dish, he turns his attention to the stove and removes the pot of boiling water from the burner. Cliff pours the pot of steaming hot noodles into a strainer. Then, after giving the strainer a couple of shakes to lose the excess water, he dumps the noodles back into the pot. On the TV screen, a pretty young black woman with naked shoulders and a big round afro looks into the camera as the off-screen announcer asks, "Would you take a bite of a red apple?" She looks at the off-screen announcer and says, "You bet I would." Then the afro gal brings a lit cigarette up from below frame, takes a big drag, and lets out a long stream of smoke with a pleasurable moan, then says, "Take a bite and feel all right. Take a bite of a red apple." Cliff takes the cheese powder packet from the ripped open box of Kraft macaroni and cheese, tears it open, and pours it on top of the noodles in the pot. He stirs up the orange powder with a big wooden spoon and a lot of muscle. The directions say to add milk and butter, but Cliff thinks if you can afford to add milk and butter, you can afford to eat something else. As Cliff prepares his dinner, he hears a whine escape from a vibrating and twitching Brandy. Cliff looks at her, placing the pot with the mac and cheese on the counter. He turns and gives Brandy his full attention. "Did I just hear a whine?" Cliff asks the canine. Brandy knows she's not supposed to whine. She just couldn't help it. She's a dog. Cliff continues to address the excited dog with an authoritative tone. "What'd I tell you about whining?" "You whine, you don't eat," Cliff instructs. "And I throw all this shit in the trash." Referring to the two cans of Wolf's Tooth dog food piled in her dog dish. "I don't want to, but I will," Cliff clarifies. "Do you understand?" Brandy answers with a distinct woof. "You better," Cliff tells her. He then picks up a big bag of gravy train, a very popular dry dog food of the era, and pours it on top of the wet food in the dog dish. It brings the mountain of dog food to a peak. Cliff could give a shit if the dry kibble spills out of the bowl all over the kitchen floor, because no matter where it goes, Brandy will find it and eat it. On the television, after the off-screen announcer has described all the different assortment of fine apple red tobacco products, The commercial cuts to a head-and-shoulder shot of famous actor Burt Reynolds smoking a red apple plastic-tipped cigar. The off-screen announcer gets his attention. "Hey, Burt Reynolds, would you take a bite of a red apple?" Burt looks at the camera and says, "Oh, you bet I would." He takes a drag from the cigar and blows it out, then says the red apple tobacco slogan, "Take a bite and feel all right. Take a bite of a red apple." Cliff grabs the pot by the handle and goes into the living room and sits in his recliner in front of the TV set. Brandy is all eyes and ears. Once Cliff is settled in his chair and eats his first forkful of Kraft macaroni and cheese, he makes a small clicking noise with the side of his mouth. That's Brandy's signal. She leaps out of the chair, bounds into the kitchen area, and wolfishly devours the food in her dog dish. Cliff changes the channel on his little TV set from KABC Channel 7 to KCBS Channel 2. And the Friday night detective show, Mannix, starring Mike Connors and Gail Fisher, as Detective Joe Mannix and his black secretary, Peggy. On the TV screen, Peggy seems worried as she relates the incidents of last night to her boss, Joe Mannix, as he sits behind his desk. "Okay, Peggy, what's up?" Mannix asks.
"We were all grooving in the club last night," Peggy tells him. "Then wham, a sudden change."
Joe tries to explain it away. "You know how these musicians are. They're temperamental cats. Who knows what got into him?" Cliff likes Mannix. Both the show and the dude Mannix. Joe Mannix is his kind of guy. In fact, there's a part of Cliff that kind of wishes he was Mannix. And if he was Mannix, the first thing he'd do is fuck Peggy. Cliff is also a big fan of the secret agent character Matt Helm. Not those insipid Dean Martin movies that are beyond asinine, but the books written by Donald Hamilton. As a character, Matt Helm is unconsciously racist, consciously misogynistic, and Cliff loves him. Cliff quotes Pulp Fiction heroes like Matt Helm, Shel Scott, and Nick Carter the way the British quote Keats and the French quote Camus. When he went to see the first Matt Helm movie at the cinema, The Silencers, he irately asked the box office girl for his money back after the first 15 minutes. If it made him sick, he could only imagine what it must have done to the author, Donald Hamilton. Dean Martin was a fucking terrible Matt Helm. But if the movies had been done like the books, Mike Connors would have been terrific. Even the drawing of Matt on the cover of the books looks like Connors. As Mannix and Peggy continue their scene, Cliff puts down the cooking pot filled with noodles and picks up the issue of TV Guide. As Brandy wolfs down her mountain of food, Cliff looks up this week's episode of Mannix and reads the synopsis out loud. Death in a minor key. Mannix searches for Peggy's missing boyfriend, a Negro musician who's escaped from a road gang. Heading south, the detective faces a run-in with an enigmatic police chief, a bigoted witness, and a ubiquitous interloper. Cliff tosses the TV Guide aside, picks the pot of orange and yellow food back up, and sticks a forkful in his mouth. As he chews, he asks himself and Brandy, "What's a ubiquitous interloper?" Approximately 20 miles away in Chatsworth, California, on what's left of a dilapidated Western town movie set known as Spawn Movie Ranch, the 80-year-old George Spawn sits in his house in his bathrobe and pajamas on his couch, watching the same Mannix episode at the same time. He watches the show with his 21-year-old red-headed and freckled-faced caretaker, Squeaky. They watch TV like this every night. He sits on his couch in his bathrobe and pajamas, while she lays sprawled out on the couch with her head in his lap. Since George is blind, Squeaky describes the action on the television screen to the sightless old man. So that nigger that works for Mannix is asking Joe to help find that nigger trumpet player boyfriend of hers from the first scene.
"Peggy's a nigger?"
George squawks with surprise. Squeaky rolls her eyes and says, I tell you that every week.
Chapter 5 Pussycat's Creepy Crawl. Pasadena, California, February 7th, 1969, 2:20 a.m. It's 2 o'clock in the morning on Greenbrier Lane in a suburban housing tract in an affluent section of Pasadena, California. Up and down both sides of the cul-de-sac street runs a collection of suburban houses with manicured front lawns, with upper-middle-class white people inside. At this time of night, except for a random cat or bold coyote who ventured down out of the hills to eat out of trash cans, there is no movement in the neighborhood whatsoever. All the residents of this street seem fast asleep, safe behind locked doors, in their comfy beds with soft purring air conditioners. Standing on the sidewalk in front of one dark house, with a homey mailbox in front that reads The Hirschbergs, are 5 members of Charlie Manson's family. Chip Fronttooth Clem, Sadie, Froggy, one of the youngest family members, Deborah Jo Hillhouse, a.k.a. Pussycat, and Charlie himself. Charlie stands behind Deborah Jo. His 2 hands rest on her shoulders as he quietly and softly speaks into her ear. Okay, Pussycat, Charlie purrs, it's your time. Time to cross the line. Time to face fear. Time to face fear in the face. And now, honey child, it's time you do it by your lonesome. Deborah Jo reminds him that this isn't her first creepy crawl. Her spiritual leader acknowledges, yes, she has, but not on her own. He reminds her of the family philosophy of there being strength in numbers. As he explains it, that's why we do what we do, how we do it, and why how we live is ultimately important. But then he clarifies as his fingers gently massage her shoulder blades under her dirty black t-shirt. But also important is individual achievement. Testing oneself. Facing one's fears. And one only faces one's fears by themselves. That's why I'm compelling you to do this, Deborah Jo. Charlie is the only person on God's green earth, other than her father, that she still allows to call her by her born name rather than her adopted one. I want to do this, Deborah Jo says, not too convincingly. Why do you want to do this? Charlie asks. Because you want me to, she answers. Yes, I do want you to, Charlie agrees. But I don't want you to do it for me, and I don't want you to do it for them, jerking his head toward the other kids. I want you to do it for yourself. Charlie's fingertips on her shoulder blades feel the slight trembling of Deborah Jo's body. I can feel you trembling, pretty girl. I'm not scared, she protests. Shh, he hushes her. It's okay. No need to lie. He explains to the dark-haired beauty, 97% of everybody you've ever met in your life and 97% of everybody you'll ever meet in your life has spent 97% of their lives running away from fear. But not you, pretty girl, he whispers. You're walking toward fear. Fear is the point. Without fear, there is no point. While Deborah Jo's trembling doesn't subside, her body under Charlie's touch does seem to relax. Standing behind her, Charlie leans forward and into her right ear asks in a soft whisper, "Do you trust me?" "You know I do," she says. "I love you." "And I love you, Deborah Jo," Charlie tells her. "And it's that love that ever so slightly nudges you toward greatness. I'm in your heart, Pussycat.
I'm in your paws, I'm in your tail, I'm in your nose, and I'm in your pussycat skull.
Charlie's fingers come off her shoulders, and he wraps his arms around the young girl, embracing her from behind. She leans her weight back against him, and they both slowly sway from side to side, shifting their weight from their left foot to their right foot, rocking her like a baby in his arms.
Allow me the privilege of guiding you through this, and the girl who emerges from that house will be gargantuanly more powerful than the girl who enters it.
Then Charlie unwraps his arms from around her waist, takes a small step backward, and slaps the ass of her blue jean cutoffs, moving her forward toward the Hirschberg house. In 1968, Terry Melcher, record producer of the Byrds and brainchild behind Paul Revere and the Raiders, and boy wonder of Columbia Records, spent a good amount of time around Charlie Manson and his family when they were encamped at the Hollywood home of Dennis Wilson and sponging off the Beach Boy. Terry Melcher was never quite as convinced of Charlie's musical talent as Wilson was. When it came to Manson's musical aspirations, Terry didn't think Charlie was without talent. Terry's honest opinion of Charlie's music was that Manson was very, very, very not bad. But if Charlie Manson did have anything to offer, it was that of a folky singer-songwriter type. And in that plentiful congregation, Charlie couldn't hold a flickering birthday next to Neil Young, Phil Oakes, Dave Van Ronk, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Mickey Newbury, Lee Dresser, Sammy Walker, or frankly, any of the known folk names of the time. Also, the folk scene as it existed only a few short years earlier was dead. By that time, all the folkies who had made a name for themselves were plugging into amps and trying to be rock stars. And since Terry Melcher represented Columbia Records, and they already had Bob Dylan, they didn't need Charlie Manson. Besides, Melcher wasn't in the acoustic singer-songwriter business anymore, as if he ever was. Paul Revere and the Raiders had made him one of the kings of top 40 radio pop. He wasn't raiding the Vanguard Records label, trying to poach talent for Columbia. He was looking for the next gimmicky band of cute, shaggy-haired boys who could produce catchy novelty records, play on American Bandstand, and all the other local TV station rock shows. Groovy, Boss City, The Real Dawn Steele Show, Where the Action Is, It's Happening. And vie for space inside the pages of 16 and Tiger Beat magazines. That might have been Bobby Beausoleil, but sure wasn't Charles Manson. It wasn't that Charlie didn't have talent. He had a little talent. But what he didn't have was the discipline to nurture the talent that he did have. If Charlie had a stronger songbook, it wouldn't have persuaded Terry to record a Manson album for Columbia, but it might have resulted in Melcher bringing one of Charlie's songs to Linda Ronstadt to record. Terry did think Charlie was one interesting far-out cat. But even in those regards, Terry wasn't as fascinated with him as his other friends Dennis Wilson and Greg Jacobson were. The real reason Terry Melcher spent so much time with Charlie and the family when they were encamped at Dennis Wilson's pad wasn't due to any potential that the record producer saw in Manson in a business sense. It was due to the fact that Terry loved fucking a 15-year-old dark-haired angel named Deborah Jo Hillhouse, who had taken up with the family. When Terry first met her, she still went by her real name, Deborah Jo. But shortly afterward, she only answered to her family name, Pussycat. Deborah Jo had joined Charlie Manson when she was 15. At the time, the youngest of the bunch, and she was undoubtedly the beauty of the bunch. Only the statuesque Leslie Van Houten gave her any competition, and Terry Melcher wasn't the only one. Dennis Wilson loved fucking Deborah Jo, too. In fact, the only serious connections Manson ever made in Los Angeles music scene weren't due to Charlie's music, but due to the allure of Deborah Jo Hillhouse's pubescent pussy. Deborah Jo held a special place in the heart of Terry Melcher. If Deborah Jo could sing,
She's the one who would have gotten a record deal. And bear in mind, this was all occurring during the time that Terry Melcher was living with 60s-era zeitgeist beauty, Candice Bergen. But even with beautiful blonde Candy Bergen at home, Terry couldn't pass up pussycat encounters. At one point, his affection got so brazen that he tried to hire Deborah Jo as a house girl and move her into his Cielo Drive home with Candy and himself. Candice Bergen might have been oblivious about a lot of things, but she knew enough to squash that idea. Deborah Jo Hillhouse had an unaffected little kitten quality. That's why Charlie named her Pussycat. That left many older men smitten, including a few members of the Straight Satans, the motorcycle gang that hung out with Charlie and the family when they lived at Spawn Ranch. Something that made Deborah Jo unique from all the other girls that Charlie collected was Deborah Jo still had a relationship with her father, and her father had a relationship with Charlie. All the other girls, to one degree or another, joined Charlie's family in response to their damaged relationship with their family. Disowning your parents, divorcing your real family, becoming a member of your new family, with Charlie as your daddy. That was all part of Manson's spiel. But in Deborah Jo Hillhouse's case, it was through her father that she first met Charlie a year earlier. One afternoon after having sex in Dennis Wilson's billiard room, while they shared a joint and drank ice-cold bottles of Mexican beer, Terry Melcher quizzed Deborah Jo about how she came to first be acquainted with Charles Manson. Deborah Jo told him, "My dad picked him up hitchhiking." "Wait a minute," a surprised Terry said. "You met Charlie through your dad?" She nodded her bushy brunette head yes. "Charlie was hitching," she repeated. "Dad picked him up. They started talking. They grooved. So Dad brought him home for dinner. That's when we first met." Terry took a big hit off the joint and passed it to Deborah Jo. While holding the reefer smoke in his lungs, he asked, "How long after that did you go off with Charlie?" "That night," she told him. "I snuck out of the house. And we bawled in Dad's car. Then I got the car keys, and we took the car and drove off together." Holy shit, Terry thought. How the fuck does a little runt like Charlie pull that off? I mean, some of those ugly hippie sluts like Mary Bruner and Patty Krenwinkel, okay, but a little hot piece of ass like Deborah Jo? Then Deborah Jo told him the whole wild tale of Manson and the Hillhouses, ending with her father asking Charlie if he could join the family, to which Terry exclaimed, "You gotta be fucking kidding me." Deborah Jo smiled and shook her head no, but then added, "But even Charlie thought that was too weird." Jesus fucking Christ, Terry thought. He couldn't even get Candy Bergen to agree to a female hippie maid, while Charlie apparently had no problem influencing everybody he met to do whatever he needed them to do. Whatever charm Charlie possessed might be lost on Terry, but it was obvious to even Melcher that he had something. In his day, he'd seen rock stars manipulate hippie girls to do some pretty outrageous shit, but their fathers? That was a whole other level of influence. Terry doubted even Mick Jagger could pull that shit off. Deborah Jo, knees visibly shaking, slowly approaches the Hirschberg house. She crosses the dew-covered front lawn. She feels the wetness of the grass against the soles of her huge bare feet, and the slight chill is invigorating. When she steps off the lawn onto the concrete pathway that leads toward the backyard gate, she leaves a trail of wet footprints behind her. She reaches her hand over the wooden gate door and, quietly as she can, lifts the rusty metal hinge on the other side, pushes the door open, and enters the backyard. Her friends watching from the sidewalk slowly disappear from view. Now Pussycat is by herself on the Hirschbergs' private property. She scans the surroundings. There's a kidney-shaped pool, green grass,
A big tree, a couple of picnic tables, and a couple of heavily played with children's big wheels. But other than the big wheels, the backyard is as nice and neat and manicured as the front of the house. Then the voice of Charlie whispers in her ear, "How's your heart?" She quietly answers the voice in her head out loud, "Beating like a jackhammer." "Calm it down, pussycat," he purrs. "Them jungle drums will wake up the whole damn block. Get a hold of it," he instructs. "And get a hold of yourself. Take in your surroundings." She examines the backyard with a touch more thoughtfulness, her rapid heartbeat ever so slightly decreasing. "Who lives there?" he asks her. "I don't know. The Hirschbergs, I guess." "Not their names," he whispers sharply. "Who are they? Do they have kids? Do you see toys?" She looks at the big wheels and nods her head yes. "A lot of toys?" he asks. "A swing set?" "No," she answers. "Just a couple of big wheels." "What does that tell you?" he asks. "I don't know. What should it tell me?" "Hey, pretty girl," he gently scolds her. "I'm the one talking in question marks. You're the one answering in periods. Got it?" She nods her head yes. So either they have kids or they know kids, Charlie figures. Like maybe grandma and grandpa. We'll answer that question later. Are they rich? She nods her head yes. "How do you know?" Charlie challenges. "They live here, don't they?" she says somewhat sarcastically. "Not so fast, pussycat," Charlie warns. "Don't judge a book by its cover, little darling. They could be renters. They could be four stewardesses or cocktail waitresses living together, pooling the rent." Then he suddenly asks, "Do they have a pool?" "Yes," she says. "Touch the water," he orders. Pussycat creeps across the grass, covering most of the backyard, over to the swimming pool, and then dips her fingers in the water. Once her hand feels the wetness, the voice inside her head asks, "Is it warm?" She nods her head yes. "Then they're rich," Charlie explains. "Only rich people can afford to heat their pool all the time." "That makes sense," Pussycat thinks. "Are you ready to enter the house?" Charlie whispers. She nods her head yes. Charlie gets sharp. "Don't nod your head, bitch. I asked you a question. Are you ready to enter the house?" "Yes," she says. "Yes, what?" he asks. "Yes, sir," she guesses. He gets loud and irate. "Not yes, sir, goddammit, and what the fuck did I tell you about those question marks?" Then she answers, louder than she should considering the situation. "Yes, I am." A jubilant Charlie answers back in her brain. "There you go, that's my pretty girl." "What kind of door they got leading from the backyard to the house?" She looks at the house and answers, "Sliding glass door." "Well, then you're in luck, kiddo. Them the kind of doors the safe and secure tend to forget to bolt. Now creep on over and see how lucky you are." As her bare feet inch over the wet grass toward the concrete of the backyard patio, Deborah Jo thinks, "If I'm really lucky, the door will be bolted shut and I can go home." She reaches the glass door and lowers on her haunches. She peers inside. Everything is dark, no movement. She listens intently, except for the jungle drums of her tom-tomming heart, which has resumed rhythmically beating again. She hears no sound. With one arm, she reaches up and yanks on the heavy sliding glass door. It doesn't slide open. Charlie pops back in her head again. "Those doors can be a little heavy. Try again harder, and with both hands." This time she grabs the handle with both hands and gives the door a bigger yank. It slides partially open. Once she saw it actually move, she caught her breath. Oh, shit, she thinks. I'm gonna have to go in there. She can hear Charlie's grin in her brain. Then he enters her soul to co-pilot her through the next phase of the creepy crawl. Now, before you enter the house, squash your ego. Cease to exist. Keep on all fours like the pussycat you are. You ain't got no more energy than a neighborhood cat exploring a house that left a back door open, understand? She nods her head, yes. Keep the sliding door open, he tells her, in case you have to make a fast getaway. Pussycat moves aside the curtain, and while on all fours, she crawls inside the house. She enters on her hands and knees and moves across the hard, cool linoleum floor of the kitchen into the shag-carpeted living room area. Once in the middle of the living room, she sits her ass on the floor, lets her eyes adjust to the darkness, taking in her surroundings. Charlie continues with his question marks. Who are these people? Are they old? Are they middle-aged? Are they parents or grandparents? I don't know, she answers. Look at the furniture, he tells her. Look at the knickknacks. Pussycat scans the room. She looks at the framed pictures on the wall on the TV, the doodads on the mantle above the fireplace. She sees the hi-fi stereo unit with a stack of LPs leaned up against the wall. She crawls over to the records and flips through the stack. Rudy Valley, Kate Smith, Jackie Gleason, Frankie Lane, Jack Jones, John Gary. Broadway cast albums, South Pacific, Fiddler on the Roof, No No Nanette, Exodus, motion picture soundtrack. They're old, Pussycat tells Charlie. I'm guessing grandparents. Well, let's not guess, Deborah Jo. Let's deduce, he asks. Do children live there? She says, I don't know. Well, look around, he says. She does. The place is definitely tidy. Pussycat responds, there's a few toys in the backyard, but I don't think kids live here. Why not? Charlie asks. Because the people who live here are old, she's decided. Old people are clean, tidy, everything in its place. That's a luxury folks with children don't have. Good for you, Pussycat. She can feel Charlie's smile shoot through her entire body. How's that heart of yours doing? Calm. I believe you. Can you see the stairs? She nods her head yes. How's that ego? Non-existent. Then you might be ready to rise off the floor and stand. Pussycat rises from the floor to a standing position. The room looks very different standing at her full height. She pulls her black t-shirt off over her head and through her bushy hair, letting it fall to the shag carpet floor. She then unbuttons and unzips her Levi's cutoffs and slides them quietly down her long bare legs. Then finally she peels off her filthy panties and drops them on her pile of discarded clothes. Once she's shed all her clothes, the naked girl bends down, lifts the cutoffs out of the pile, reaches in the bulbous side pocket, and yanks out one red light bulb. She places the red light bulb in her mouth, her lips wrapping around the silver metal coil. Then, naked on all fours, she crawls up the carpeted stairway that leads to the house's second floor. Her nude feline body softly and quietly slinks up toward where the bedrooms are. When she reaches the top of the stairs, her head slowly turns to the right, then to the left, and it's to the left where she makes out the door that appears to be the entrance of the master bedroom. No more Charlie in her head now. Deborah Jo is completely on her own. On her knuckles and knees, She prances down the hall like her nicknamed namesake toward the half-open bedroom door. With her ego-less energy, she silently pokes her head through the doorway and peers into the dark bedroom. From her vantage point on the floor, Pussycat discovers she deduced correctly. That yes, indeed, this is the master bedroom, and the couple who lie asleep in their marital craftmatic king-sized bed are grandparent age. Pussycat crawls into the room, twisting her naked body to fit through the open space, careful not to brush up against the bedroom door, lest she be betrayed by a squeaky hinge. Once her hands and knees have maneuvered her feet inside the room, her eyes rise to the surface of the bed. The old man asleep in his bed, dressed in blue pajamas, with up and down white stripes, is lying on the closest side to her and the door. The room has the fragrance of Bengay, Pine Sol evergreen air freshener, Old Spice, and foot odor. The air conditioner sticking out of the far right bedroom window hums a good, solid baseline noise that helps mask her subtle movements. That's the good part. The bad part is, it's much colder in the master bedroom than it was in the living room and the upstairs hallway. Chill bumps sprout up across her exposed skin like hives. The goosebumps that pop up on her naked derriere give that young girl, that Charlie christened Pussycat, the feeling of what having a tail might be like. Indulging in the whole house cat masquerade, she gives her bony ass a little wiggle. Yet the chilly temperature doesn't act as an obstacle. Instead, like the cool bracing waters of a mountain stream after the initial sensation of cold air making contact with warm flesh, she finds the shudder that runs through her body invigorating. She inches closer to the side of the bed. Then Deborah Jo slowly rises from her all-fours feline position to her knees. Her face is very close to the face of the sleeping old man reclining in his bed. The red light bulb sticking out of her mouth gives the young girl an inhuman, expressionless demeanor, sort of a cross between a robot and a blow-up fuck doll. Only her pronounced dark eyebrows, which verge on one long unibrow, indicate any sense of expression. She examines the face of the sleeping old man, his labored breathing that veers ever so close to snoring, his wispy white hair strands that spring up from his bulbous skull, every single strand going its own way, the sunken lips on his toothless mouth. She looks over at the bedside end table and, sure enough, next to a pair of glasses, a lamp, and a small clock, sit a set of false teeth soaking in a cloudy glass of water. Her curious gaze goes from the dentures to the sleeping old fart to his elderly female companion sleeping next to him. She's a touch on the fat side when compared to her bony, ghoul-like husband. Unlike the old man's every white stringing follicle for itself, the old lady has her bright orange-dyed hair done up in tight curls that obviously must require weekly beauty shop visits and quarter jars of dippity-doo to maintain. Deborah Jo takes her hand and places it above the sleeping old man's face and wiggles her fingers. He doesn't stir in the slightest, just continues his loud, rhythmic breathing. She's feeling confident now. So she slowly rises to a standing position, off her two knees onto her two feet. After all the time she's spent close to the ground in her cat-like posture, standing upright at her full height gives her the sensation of being a Gulliver-like giant. Using the balls of her feet, she silently pads away from the bed and its inhabitants, across the room, over to the bedroom window that faces the front of the house. The curtains to the window are open, and she looks through the glass and sees Charlie and her friends standing together in front of the house on the sidewalk. Froggy is the first one to spot her and jumps up and gives Deborah Jo an excited wave. The rest of the group wave up at her like they're restaging the closing credits of the Beverly Hillbillies. Deborah Jo, red light bulb sticking out of her mouth, looks down at them through the Hirschberg's bedroom window and waves back. Quietly, she moves over to a wooden chair parked in front of the woman of the house's vanity table, lifts it off the floor, and brings it up to the window. Also by the window is a bedroom lamp. Sneaking a quick glance at the sleeping couple to make sure she hasn't disturbed them, she begins to slowly unscrew the top of the lamp that holds the shade in place. Once she's done that, and has the screw top on the table, she silently lifts the lampshade from its home base and quietly places it on the floor, all the while watching the couple in bed for any sign of consciousness creeping up. So far, so good. Keeping both eyes peeled on the old fogies for a reaction, she unscrews the light bulb. This is by far the noisiest thing she's done. Yet the couple's rhythmic breathing, the air conditioner, and her squashed ego keep the equilibrium in the room from changing drastically. Once she is through her final rotation, Deborah Jo lifts the light bulb clear of the lamp, then places it noiselessly on the couple's carpeted bedroom floor. The brunette intruder removes the red light bulb from her mouth and screws it into the lamp's light socket. Once it can turn no farther, she knows she's accomplished her task. She twists the tiny bulb on the lamp till it clicks, and the room is bathed in a glowing red light. She watches the couple in bed for a reaction to the change in atmosphere, ready to race out of there if the red light has disturbed their REM. But the low-watt red bulb is still dark enough not to disturb their slumber. So, she climbs up onto the chair by the window, her naked body framed in the windowsill, backlit by a red-hued Amsterdam-like tableau in the middle of Pasadena. She smiles down at her friends below on the sidewalk, who jump up and down in excitement at Deborah Jo's accomplishment. The 16-year-old brunette begins gyrating a go-go dance in the window for the amusement of her friends outside. They applaud and cheer her on. She undulates up and down, dancing wilder and wilder, while her friends whoop and whistle, till she jumps off the chair, runs across the floor, and leaps into the bed with the sleeping old couple with a cackling, "Geronimo!" The old couple wakes to find this naked brunette teenager rolling around in bed with them, laughing like a lunatic. The old woman lets out a blood-curdling scream as the old man sputters, "What the hell?" Deborah Jo throws her arms around the old man's neck and plants a big kiss on his toothless mouth. When he tries to scream, she shoves her tongue inside of it. Then she lets go, hops out of the bed, runs out of the room, down the stairs, through the living room, snatching her clothes as she goes by, out the open sliding glass door, through the backyard and the backyard gate, across the front lawn and down Greenbrier Lane with her family, laughing.
Chapter 6. Hollywood or Bust. Outside of Dallas, Texas, 4 years earlier. The rodeo cowboy in the dirty white 59 Cadillac Coupe de Ville, pulling a dirty white horse trailer with a dusty brown horse in it, spotted the young lady with her thumb sticking out on the side of the road on the highway heading out of Dallas about a quarter of a mile before he reached her. She sported a tight pink t-shirt, a banana-colored miniskirt, long bare legs and bare feet, a big white sun hat, and a canvas duffel bag. Once the cowboy got closer, he saw that tight pink t-shirt covered two large bouncing boobs, and her long bare legs were uncommonly white. When he pulled over to the side of the road and she bent down to look at him through the passenger side car door window, he noted she had long golden blonde hair hanging down from the white sun hat. She was about 22 and a goddamn good-looking gal. "Need a lift?" he asked rhetorically.
"I sure do," said the blonde sans Texas accent.
The cowboy turned down Merle Haggard crooning about Tulare dust on the radio and said, "Where are y'all going?"
"California,"
was the big boob blonde's reply. Spitting snuff juice into an empty Texaco paper coffee cup, tenth filled with brown saliva, the cowboy chuckled.
"California. Well, that's ways away."
"I know," she said, nodding. "Can you help me out?"
"I don't know about California," the cowboy qualified. "But I intend to get out of Texas by 7 this evening. I could drop you off in New Mexico."
"That's a start, cowboy," she smiled.
"Well, get in, cowgirl," he smiled back.
Before she committed to climbing into the fellow's caddy, she examined the cowboy more closely.
He was somewhere around 47, handsome but weather-beaten, sort of like his Cadillac. He wore a white straw cowboy hat on his head, a cream-colored snap-button country and western type shirt with armpit stains, and had a big pinch of snuff under his lip. She looked in the back seat, which had a duffel bag in it not too different from hers, except his had an olive-green military look to it, while hers was black and had the 7-Up logo on it. She looked past the fins of the Cadillac at the horse trailer attached to the back hitch and asked,
"You got a horse in that trailer?"
"You know I do," he said.
"What's his name?" she asked.
"Her name is Honeychild," he drawled.
"Well," she said, smiling, "I suppose a fella names his mare Honeychild ain't gonna rape me."
"Well, that's your first mistake. A dude with a big black stallion named Boston Strangler? Now, that's a fella you can trust." He winked.
"Well," the blonde said, "here goes nothing." Throwing her duffel bag in the back seat next to his, she opened the door and climbed into the Cadillac.
"That door's kind of fucked up," the cowboy instructed. "You gotta slam it real hard."
She opened the door again and followed his instructions, slamming it real hard.
"That's the spirit," he said as he pulled back onto the highway.
The cowboy driver got the conversation started.
"So, where are you going in California?"
He turned Merle Haggard back up to decent volume.
"L.A., San Francisco, or Pomona?"
the blonde girl asked.
"Who would hitch from Texas to Pomona?"
"Well, I just might," the cowboy confessed. "But I ain't no blonde bathing beauty."
"Los Angeles," she said.
"You going to be a surfer?" the cowboy asked. "Like Annette Funicello?"
"I don't think she's a real surfer," said the blonde. "In fact, neither her or Frankie even got a tan. You got more of a tan than they got."
"Yeah, I got about 5 more lines in my forehead than they got, too."
Looking at his pretty passenger, he said, "And bless your sweet heart, calling my sun damage a tan." The young hitcher introduced herself to the older cowboy. They traded names and shook hands.
"So where are you going?" the cowboy asked again.
"Los Angeles. My boyfriend is waiting for me."
The blonde had no boyfriend waiting for her in Los Angeles. That's just what she planned to tell lone men who might give her a ride. She then proceeded to talk for the next 45 minutes about her imaginary boyfriend, which was all part of her method of hitchhiking. She gave him the name Tony. It was during her Tony spiel that she started trusting the white-hatted cowboy somewhat, because he was neither disappointed nor uninterested in her new life in L.A. with Anthony.
"Well, if you ask me," he drawled, "this Tony's one lucky fella."
"Where are you and Honeychild off to?" the blonde asked.
Now it was the cowboy's turn to be a little cagey. He and Honeychild were off to Prescott, Arizona. See, the cowboy was a rodeo rider. He just finished one rodeo over the weekend in Dallas called Wild West Weekend, where he won zip-a-dee-doo-da and banged up everything that wasn't already busted to begin with.
Now he was off to Prescott, his hometown, for another rodeo the weekend after next.
The Prescott Frontier Days was the first rodeo ever held back in 1888, and the cowboy would be damned if he was going to lose in front of his hometown audience.
All this he kept mum with the leggy blonde sitting Indian style on his passenger seat, cause, frankly, he didn't know if he wanted her company that long. So he talked in detail about the rodeo in Dallas he'd just left, and vaguely about where he and his horse were off to. But as the two drove and talked, they got to know each other better, and little by little, their defenses dropped away. Being from Texas and the daughter of a military man, she liked this witty shit-kicker good old boy. And he liked her too, and not just to look at. She was very bright. That was clear from just a casual conversation. As they talked more, she even revealed she spoke fluent Italian. Due to a time, her family was stationed in Italy because of her father's military career, which was enough for the cowboy to classify her as a genius, especially since most of the gals he went for could barely speak English. He was partial to Mexican girls. The barefoot blonde would have to be dim not to realize how pretty she was. But she didn't define her personality by how she looked. She defined it by her sweet disposition, her curiosity about other people, and her genuine excitement about adventure. And while a touch cautious about the dangers that could befall a young woman on the road, she was nevertheless thrilled. And you could color the cowboy charmed. In fact, it was fair to say he even got a crush on her. But since this young gal was probably no more than 22, she fell outside of the range of his morally approved parameters. He had a rule to never engage in slap and tickle with anybody younger than his 25-year-old daughter. Now, his rule might be downgraded to a guideline if his passenger insisted. But he was aware enough to know how unlikely that was. Their relationship was that of pretty half-dressed passenger and friendly driver, and that was all right by him. They stopped for dinner at a choke and puke once they crossed the Texas state line into New Mexico. If she had been broke, he would have offered to buy her a bowl of chili, but since she wasn't, he didn't. They drove 2 more hours till he pulled into a motel around 9 at night.
Okay, the blonde thought. If the cowboy's gonna make a play, now's the time.
But she didn't give him the opportunity. Before he could even offer the back seat of his car for her to sleep in, she had her duffel bag out of the back and was hugging him goodbye. He watched her bare feet walk off into the dark distance. During their time together, about 6 hours, when she got comfortable with him, she revealed her real reason for going to Los Angeles was to be an actress and work in movies, or at least television. She admitted she didn't want to say it before because it was such a cliche. Also, it sounded like such a pie-in-the-sky daydream coming from a Texas beauty pageant winner that it even made her look a little stupid. And if people thought that, they wouldn't be alone. Because that's exactly what her father thought.